You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. All it took for 100 people to die during a show by the hair metal band Great White was a sudden burst from four giant sparklers that ignited the acoustical foam lining the station nightclub. But who was at fault, and who would pay? This being Rhode Island, the two questions wouldn't necessarily have the same answer. Within 24 hours, the governor of Rhode Island and the local police chief were calling for criminal charges. Although the investigation had barely begun, key evidence still needed to be gathered, and many of the victims hadn't been identified. Though many parties could be held responsible, fingers pointed quickly at the two brothers who owned the club. But were they really to blame? Best-selling author and three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist Scott James investigates all the central figures, including the band's manager and lead singer, the fire inspector, the maker of the acoustical foam, as well as the brothers. Drawing on first-hand accounts, interviews with many involved, and court documents, James explores the rush to judgment about what happened that left the victims and their families, whose stories he also tells, desperate for justice. Trial by Fire is the heart-wrenching story of the fire's aftermath because, while the fire, one of America's deadliest, lasted minutes, the search for the truth would take years. The book that we're featuring this evening is Trial by Fire, a devastating tragedy, 100 lives lost, and a 15-year search for truth. With my special guest journalist and author, Scott James. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Scott James.
Hey, thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. As I just mentioned before we went on the air, this is an incredibly exciting book, and it is a heart-wrenching book at the same time. It's hard not to shed some tears at these very, very, very personal stories of devastation and this trial by fire. Let's start just by just your connection to these owners of this club.
Sure.
The Durinians, and just briefly your background what really brought you to this story.
Well, you should probably start by explaining to the basics to folks about what exactly happened here. So this was February 20th, 2003. Rock band Great White sets off fireworks, and in a matter of minutes, this nightclub becomes an inferno when 100 people are dead, hundreds of others are injured. The ripple effect is felt by the thousands in this community. It's a very tight-knit community of Rhode Island, the smallest state where it seems like everybody is connected to everybody else. And I grew up in a suburb of Providence, and so I really consider this to be the worst thing to happen where I grew up. But I've long ago, and many, many years before the fire, had moved to California and was not really part of the community there. But I would come home, and I'm a journalist, and I worked in television and in newspapers, and I would come home to see my family and friends a few times a year, and people would say, you know, this fire, all these people died, there were never any trials, everything was settled, plea bargains, settlements, and so nothing was really vetted in court, and there were a lot of unanswered questions. And people thought that there had been a miscarriage of justice, that justice was not served, that there had been a rush to judgment, all these questions. And so about 10 years ago, I decided to start looking into the case. And I did have an edge over some of the other journalists who had pursued this story because two of the central figures, the nightclub business owners, they didn't actually own the building, they owned the business, these two guys, Jeffrey and Michael Dedarian. And when I was a news director in Providence, so it means basically I'm the person who oversaw a TV news department for many years, one of my employees was a reporter named Jeffrey Dedarian. He would turn out to be the co-owner of this club. So I thought, well, if we're going to look into this, I'll go to Jeffrey because we worked together, even though it was more than 25 years ago now. But at least I knew him, and I thought perhaps he would speak to me. And what I discovered was that even though Jeffrey had been a TV news reporter and a journalist himself, he and his brother hated journalists. They felt that they had been mistreated by the media and had vowed never again to speak to another reporter or journalist. And so I commissioned the picture, and it actually took years to gain Jeffrey's trust, to get him to tell me anything, and to get him to introduce me to his brother Michael. And then after that, other people came forward. Other people told me their stories for the first time, and it was really illuminating that much of what the public had been told about the fire turned out there were other facts to consider. And so the book really, for the first time, kind of lays out all the facts of this case so that people can decide for themselves what happened, was it a crime, and if it was a crime, who was really guilty.
You talk about some of the characters that you were able to have access to and survivors and people involved in this incredible fire. And one of those is Fred Crisitomi. You chronicle his story with his fiancée, Gina Russo. And so you open the book basically with Fred and Gina coming to this concert and the reason why they even came to the club in the first place. And the idea that Fred had forgotten his crucifix. Tell us a little bit about Fred and Gina, and just introduce these very, very important characters.
Well, it's really interesting, like how so much of this tragedy, decisions that seem, you know, possibly unimportant, turn out to be consequential and are life and death decisions. So the book opens with Fred and Gina in the car, and they just parked. First of all, kind of a new relationship, less than a year old, but they had fallen in love, and it was not their first time. Gina was a divorced with kids, but they were in love and did everything together. Fred was the life of the party, he was always itching to do something. This was that type of guy, larger than life character. And they had gone to a movie, and the movie had already started. And they're like, well, we don't want to see a movie that's already started, so what else can we do? And eventually they decide to go to this club, this nightclub, with this band's great, Jack Russell's Great White, is about to perform. So they get there and they park, and Fred realizes that he's left his good luck cross, probably at home. He probably took it off while he was showering and forgot to put it back on. Now, he's only a few minutes away from the club, and they actually have a little discussion in the car, like, well, should we go back and get it? And eventually Fred says, you know what, you know, whatever, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not, jewelry's not a big deal to me, so let's just go in. But that decision to go into that club rather than go home and get that good luck cross and put it on was a life and death decision. By going to that club, they were there when the show actually started. They were there when the band took the stage and lit off those fireworks. The fireworks ignited the foam on the inside of the club walls, foam that should have been sound foam, that should have been, you know, sound, should have been fireproof, fire resistant, but instead was packing foam, the type of foam you would use in sending things in the mail, which is highly flammable. It's an accelerant. It's the equivalent of solid gasoline. In fact, a federal investigation determined that the walls of the nightclub had about 13 gallons of gasoline, the equivalent of 13 gallons of gasoline on the wall. So when that fire started, it just went off like a torch. Well, Fred and Gina are right in the front row, and he immediately senses danger. A lot of people did not sense danger. In fact, when the fire started, people mostly didn't move. They were there dancing and cheering and seeing the columns of flames and thinking that it was part of the show. I mean, we see pyrotechnics at rock concerts all the time. So many people were doomed because they stood there thinking this was part of a special effect, and they did not run for the exits, and they died. Fred immediately senses there's a problem, and so he tries to get Gina out, and they try to go through the stage door, which is close to where they are, but they're turned back because, well, that actually becomes a real debate in the investigation as to what happened. Why were they turned back? We know now that door was shut during shows and had to remain shut because there were so many complaints that by the neighbors about the noise coming from this rock and roll club, and that door was right next to the stage. So if the door was open, the sound went into the neighborhood, the neighbors called the police. So the door was watched carefully and kept closed during the performance, and there is a performance happening as Fred sees these columns of flames and says, we've got to get out. So they're turned away from the door that is closest to where they are, and they head, like almost everyone else did, eventually towards the way they came in. That's kind of the way our minds are wired, right? In the panic,
right,
we're going to say, how do I get out of here? And what your brain knows is, well, you know how you got in. That's the way you should get out. Well, when hundreds of people all head to the same door simultaneously, it created a traffic jam and eventually literally a pile of people at the door that prevented people from getting out. And that's part of the reason why 100 people died. And they died, it was happening very fast. It's hard for us to imagine this, but within seconds, that fire near the stage was something like 1,400 degrees. And then within 90 seconds, the place was filled with this black smoke that was deadly. And if you were inside that building at 90 seconds after that fire started, you most likely did not get out.
Tell us for the reason for this foam and why this highly flammable foam was installed in this club. But let's go back a little bit to the ownership of this club and the real, you mentioned that you were Jeffrey's boss at one time in journalism, TV broadcasting. So
yep.
What was Jeffrey's interest and his brother in this club? And what was the state of the club in terms of ownership just recently, in terms of news?
Yeah, no,
with
I think
this
that people who are from New England might remember an old chain of Italian restaurants called Papa Brillo's. And this was an old Papa Brillo's restaurant that had been converted into a rock and roll club. I mean, it's about as basic you can get in terms of a public venue. Jeffrey worked in television news. After he worked for me, he went on to actually be quite successful working in Boston at a TV station there, WHDH Channel 7, really one of the premier local TV stations in the nation. And he was, you know, one of their star reporters. And so when something happened nationally, like the Columbine shootings, they put him on a plane and he would report from there. He reported from 9/11. He did live shots and reporting for the Today Show as an NBC affiliate. So he was at the top of his career. But as many of us who work in the news media have witnessed over the time, and he was an early witness to this is not a very stable business to be in as far as long-term career survival is concerned. And also the media landscape was changing. As we've seen, you know, a lot of news organizations have downsized or gone out of business. He was starting to see this happen, and he thought that he should have something else in his life besides being the TV news reporter to support his family. And so his brother, who was a local businessman and had several different ventures, he went to his brother and said, hey, we should do some business venture together so we can have some sort of other stable income in our lives besides, you know, for him, TV news. And they looked at a laundry chain that they thought about purchasing as an investment, and that fell through. And then this nightclub business was up for sale. And it was just the business. The club itself, the building itself, was owned by someone else. In fact, owned by the person who owned those Papa Brillo restaurants, had an investment in that. So they didn't actually own the building. The building was quite old. It dated back to, I think, the 20s or 30s when it was originally built. And it was originally built as a public venue. In fact, they had live music back in the days of the big bands. They were playing in there. And so as a result of that, because it was always a public venue for entertainment on and off during its time, it was grandfathered. So what that means, for people that don't know, is that basically the fire codes that applied early to when the building was built and expanded and established were in force. And so it was not subject to the most modern fire codes. It did not have sprinklers. Now, sprinklers are a technology that dates back to the 1800s, but they were not required in this particular building because of this grandfathering. So when this fire happens and when this, you know, foam is ignited and goes up like a torch, people have no protection from sprinklers. And we know that sprinklers probably would have saved every single life, because just a couple nights earlier in Minneapolis, an almost identical situation happened where a rock band set off fireworks indoors in a club that set the acoustic foam on fire. But that building had sprinklers, and every single person survived. So, wow. Yeah, a lot of things went wrong on a lot of different ways that led to this tragedy. People often refer to it as kind of the perfect storm of fires, because so many things went wrong all at the same time. You know, fireworks were not legal. It was not legal to light off fireworks inside that nightclub. These were 15-foot arcs of sparks in a club that had a 12-foot ceiling. So the decision to light them off was not very smart. It was definitely illegal in the state of Rhode Island to have those fireworks and to use them indoors. The band would claim that they had permission from the nightclub business owners to do this, the Dedarian brothers, but the Dedarian brothers have always maintained that that is not true. And within 24 hours of the fire, the New York Times actually did an investigation, because the band had claimed that they had permission to do fireworks. And they went to several of the venues that had hosted shows by the same band in the days leading up to the fire, and found one after another said that the band lit off fireworks without permission in their clubs too. Probably the most famous on that list was a place called the Stone Pony, which is known as kind of where Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band got their start, down in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And that nightclub owner was so angry that the band had set off fireworks there without permission, and that he saw what happened in Rhode Island, and so he released all the contracts that the band had signed down in New Jersey. And it showed, you know, these riders are very specific for rock bands, you know, down to like the type of potato chips they're going to serve in the green room. But there's no mention in any of that paperwork about fireworks or pyrotechnics, and yet it happened, and the guy was livid when it happened. I guess he read them the Riot Act, and then when he saw in what happened in Rhode Island, he went public and said, you know, they did the same thing to me. You know, we were lucky that we didn't die, but they did the same thing here. So there were a lot of questions about, did the band have permission? Did the band not have permission? But whether or not they had permission, it was illegal to set up those fireworks. So again, another thing that went wrong that was preventable.
And use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, Scott, how did it come to be that there was video camera and a photographer in this club? Tell us about this incredible...
This story is full of so many twists, and many of them incredibly cruel. Possibly one of the cruelest twists was that this tragedy was captured on video from inside the nightclub. So in 2020, we are very used to the idea of things being caught on video. It happens all the time. But in 2003, the iPhone had not even been invented yet. So it is extremely rare to capture something on video. But at the club, on the night of this tragedy, inside was a local TV news videographer, basically a photojournalist for one of the local TV stations, who was there shooting what they call B-roll. B-roll is kind of generic footage that's going to be used later by the reporter to cover in their story.
Right.
So the photojournalist is there to shoot B-roll for this upcoming story, and you can't make this up. The story he was working on was one about public venue safety. So he is rolling as the band takes the stage, as the fireworks go off, as the flame, the stage turns into columns of flames. This is why we know there's 30 seconds between when the fire starts and when panic really sets in the crowd, because it's all caught on tape. It is probably one of the most documented fires in the history of the United States. This fire is taught to every fire investigator in the United States, and most firefighters study this fire as an example of how all things can go wrong at the same time. That videotape, as horrible as it is actually used as a learning tool now, and probably has prevented many other people from dying because firefighters use this as a training tool. But yeah, just awful, a twist, yet another in this case, whereas it all was caught on tape.
Now, we didn't talk about, and it comes up later as well, but there was a reason why the brothers put this foam in this in their club.
Yes.
But also the reasons why somebody wanted that foam to be there for them to make those kinds of changes. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really interesting where we hear about, you know, neighborhood squabbles about zoning and things like that. This is really almost a classic case of how,
right,
yet again, something went horribly wrong. So when the place was a restaurant, that old Italian restaurant that had eventually become, you know, there's a lot of houses around there. It's a somewhat of a busy commercial route, but right next to it is a residential area. And everybody lived in peace and quiet for years and years. I mean, an Italian restaurant doesn't make much noise. And all of a sudden, somebody put in for a permit to turn it into some sort of bar or watering hole or something, and that was fine, except it wasn't. It wasn't really just a bar watering hole. It turned out to be a rock and roll live music venue. So literally one night, the neighbors wake up to this incredible sound disrupting their sleep, and they are angry. And it starts this campaign that goes for years and years and years against the town. They felt they were the victims of a bait and switch. They didn't get notification. Had they been told that this was going to be a rock and roll club, they would have asked for you know, something to be done to protect them from the sound. Or maybe they would have said, not here, don't do it here, not in my backyard. But they didn't have that chance, and so they felt victimized by the system in this town that allowed this to happen. So they filed complaint and complaint and complaint. Well, the Dadarians in the year 2000 decide to buy this nightclub business, and they are told immediately by the local police chief that, look, we're tired of all these complaints from the neighbors, so either you are going to deal with this sound problem from this nightclub, or we're not going to issue you a business license or an entertainment license so that you can have your shows. So, you know, this had gone on for years and years, but when the Dadarians bought it, the town saw an opportunity to deal with this, and they made it a threat, a kind of an existential threat, like, you will fix this problem that has never been fixed, or we will put you out of business. So they go on a search for answers. The first thing they do is go to the neighbors, and they say, well, what can we do? And they offered to buy them air conditioning, for example, so that they could keep their windows shut, there would be white noise, and that would help keep the sound out of their homes. One of the neighbors worked for a foam company, American Foam, and he suggested, he says he made a lot of suggestions as to how to abate the sound, but among them was foam. Well, Jeffrey Dadarian, because he had been a TV news reporter, he'd worked in radio, he was very familiar with sound foam. In fact, you could say that he was more familiar with sound foam than probably anyone else would be, because he had spent his entire career in broadcast studios that are covered in this type of foam. Every sound booth you go into, every recording studio has it. So he's like, well, I know that stuff. Yeah, that works. And so they purchased it from American Foam. They installed it. But it wasn't sound foam. It was packing foam. And that's part of what we look at in the book, is like, how did a mistake like that happen? And you actually see, for the first time, the public actually sees the letter, the fax that the brothers sent to the foam company and what they ordered. What they ordered, however, was not what they received. And the two types of foam are identical. Visually, there's no difference, even the way they feel. I mean, interesting that neighbor, the one who was an expert about foam, went to the club after the foam had been installed and stood on the stage and saw it with his close-up, touched it with his hands, and he had no idea, even as an expert, that what was on the walls of that nightclub was not sound foam, but was, in fact, deadly packing foam.
Now, let's talk about, as you do, about the tour manager, Great White's tour manager, Daniel Biachel, and his role in this. And you explained these gerbs, these giant sparklers.
Right. So basically, it's really interesting, again, how things turn on a dime. Great White, or Jack Russell's Great White, is officially the legal name of the group at that point, because they had been part of breakups and litigation, like a lot of rock bands go through, had never used fireworks as part of its shows in the past. In fact, they had appeared at the same club. This would have been probably around the year 2000 after the Darians had first purchased the nightclub business, and they didn't use any fireworks then. So there was no idea that, that people should have known that this was their shtick, because it wasn't their shtick. They incorporated fireworks as part of this new tour that they had just started a few months earlier. And so, but Daniel Beakley, that's how you say his last name, Beakley, is the person who is their tour manager, kind of like a roadie, but a little bit more elevated than that. And he had done pyrotechnics with other bands, including a band called Wasp. And so he was familiar with how to get a hold of them, and he would do this on his own, kind of a do-it-yourself thing. Now, the companies that sold him these fireworks, and this is something that's documented and made public for the first time in the book, came with a lot of warnings, and they were very explicit, even in writing. And they said, you know, basically, Dan, if you're going to be doing these pyrotechnics, here's a checklist of 10 things you need to make sure you do for safety of people if you're going to use them. And he did none of those things. I mean, some of them are really interesting and basic, like when you transport the fireworks, to make sure they're in like a lead-lined box. So, you know, we're talking about the equivalent of explosives here, so that when you're traveling on your tour bus with these explosives, you don't blow up the bus and the highway. He had them in a cardboard box, and you actually see the cardboard box in pictures from the night of the event. They said you should have your own fire extinguishers at the ready on each side of the stage, held in people's hands so that if something goes wrong, you can immediately, you know, get in there and deal with it. And that had nothing like that. They also said that he should test at the venue in the exact spot where he intends to do pyrotechnics, you know, hours before the actual show. He should do a whole test run of the system to make sure that nothing is going to go wrong. And, of course, nothing like that happened. And on and on and on and on, things like that. So, but I will say this in Dan Beakley's defense, there was no way for him to know that when he lit off these fireworks that the club itself was such a death trap, that the walls were so flammable and dangerous. That was not something that he could have anticipated. You know, a lot of people look at him and say, you know, that was idiotic for him to do those fireworks, and I see that and I understand that, but you know, there's no intent here by him or anyone else to hurt anyone, and so he could not have known that. And they had successfully used these pyrotechnics at all sorts of shows. In fact, Jack Russell used to brag about how that he could stick his head in these sparks and not hurt himself, like it was seen like a magic trick type thing. So So he would not have known that this was going to turn so deadly so quickly.
So what does the owner, co-owner Jeff, because Michael is not working that shift, that doesn't work at the club like Jeff, what is Jeff doing during this whole thing? What does he notice, and how does he make himself, how does he make it out of the club?
Well, it's interesting that Jeff is behind the bar. He's even though he's, you know, this kind of hotshot TV reporter, and in fact he's still working doing TV news reporting when he's co-owning this club on this night, he's basically a bar back. He's behind the bar with the bartenders, running down, getting beer from the cooler, things like that, just keeping the bar stocked. So he says that he didn't actually see the fireworks go off. He had his head down doing whatever he was doing, and only when it becomes clear that there's a fire and he recognizes that it's not normal, he goes running towards the stage, and so does one of the club managers and with the fire extinguisher, but they can't get past the crowd. At that point, it's a rock concert. And basically between the bar and the stage are hundreds of people who are all partying and jumping up and down and having a great time. And so immediately when it turns bad, as soon as the fire alarm goes off, which is about that 30-second mark, this is when people realize that this is serious, it's a stampede. And Jeffrey is, like many people, kind of just pushed out by the stampede outside, because the bar is towards the exits than the stage. So he runs around the nightclub, checking the exits. The stage door exit is wide open, where and the band had just come out of there and a couple of other people. But because that's where the fire started at the stage, that's where it gets to about 1,400 degrees within a matter of seconds. So that door, effectively, even though it's open, it effectively is impassable because the fire is so intense at that one spot. And then really within seconds after that, we have what's called a flashover. So a flashover is when the room when the fire becomes very superheated and things just kind of spontaneously combust. A firefighter explained it to me, basically a flashover is the moment where a fire in a room becomes a room on fire. And at that point, really all hope is kind of lost for the folks who are inside. But Jeffrey goes out in front. He's trying to get people out of that pileup at the front door. He's seen on video. Remember that news photographer? He's pushed out in the stampede. You actually see him pushed out in the stampede. And he continues to roll tape because he doesn't know. And no one knows, by the way, how deadly this fire is. In fact, right. It would be hours and hours later till people realize that even a single person had perished in the fire, let alone 100. So the news photog does what a news photographer does. He basically starts getting the wide shots of the fire. He goes, walks all around the building. And you can see Jeffrey in some of the video at the front door. He's trying to tear down to the signs that are near the front door to clear it so that people can get out of that jam up, clearing the entrance. You also see Daniel Beakley, the tour manager, who the firefighters arrive, and he's helping them try to get their hose up to the building, things like that. So you see these people and what they're doing. This is all, again, seconds have gone by, seconds and minutes. This is not something that, this is something that happens so quickly, it's kind of mind-boggling. So Jeffrey is there, he sees all of this, and he, you know, some of it we don't know. I mean, one of the challenges of writing this book was getting Jeffrey to remember things. What we do know is that Jeffrey is got blood all over himself in the aftermath. What we don't know is whose blood it is, because it's not his own. He's not cut. He's not burned. And so whose blood is that, and how did it get all over him? We don't know. Well, he doesn't remember. He remembers some things from that trauma, but not all things. And in fact, most people who live through this have suffered some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the failings in this, besides the failing of, you know, to obviously to have a safe building with proper fire inspections, in the aftermath, people did not get the help that they needed. And part of the help they did not receive was mental health care. I mean, so many people I spoke to after all of these years are still suffering. They're still messed up. It's just really awful that people did not get the intervention they needed. They were kind of really left to fend for themselves. And I think part of that was because of who they were. The people who were at that show were rockers. Most of them have tattoos, working class people, you know, whether they're waitresses or work for a moving company or electricians or whatever they are. And so this is not the typical crowd that, you know, elite charities raise money for. So after the initial trauma of this disaster, they were kind of just abandoned and left to fend for themselves. Really kind of an awful commentary about our society and our institutions that we think are going to be there to protect us or help us. They were not there for these people, either before or after this awful catastrophe.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to talk about our sponsor, Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. Do you really know what's in your multivitamin? Sugars, GMOs, synthetic fillers, artificial colorants, not to mention animal byproducts like sheep's wool and gelatin from hooves and hides, are all ingredients you might find in a multivitamin. But Ritual isn't your typical multivitamin. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly formula is made with key nutrients and forms your body can actually use, no shady extras. My wife Lisa decided to try Ritual about 8 months ago based on reading about Ritual's vitamins and nutrients and their sources as compared to other multivitamins. She decided to add Ritual Essential into her healthy eating and exercise regimen, and she believes that ritual has made a definite difference in her health every day. Now available for women, men, and teens, Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping, always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. You deserve to know what's in your multivitamin. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. Now, we talked about the club and this fire and its aftermath, and in a short order, within minutes, most people were burned beyond recognition or incinerated. You said that the temperature went up to 1,400 degrees in that building in a very, very short order. What was the capacity of the club, or the known capacity of the club, because that's going to be important later when we talk about the civil case and the trial, or the proposed trial. Let's talk right. about how many people they thought were in this fire.
One of the enduring mysteries of this case, to a large extent an unanswered question, is how many people were inside that nightclub when the fire started. One of the mistakes made early on by journalists was that they determined, I don't know how they got this, what sources they were using, because it was incorrect, the initial reporting was that the club had a capacity of 300 people, and clearly there were more than 300 people there because 100 were dead and a couple hundred more were hurt. So immediately the local newspaper and the local media concluded that the club was illegally over capacity. The truth was that the nightclub had a capacity of 404. And so whether they exceeded that is something that is still open to debate. And I do quite a bit of reporting on that and try to look at it from all the different angles. And there are, you know, the Attorney General had warned the media immediately after the fire to not to jump to conclusions about that, because this is a place where it was a fluid situation. The way I describe it in the book is that people were in and out of the nightclub. So the parking lot was kind of a party in and of itself, besides the club. And so, you know, this is the days when people could still smoke inside a nightclub. That was allowed in 2003, at least in Rhode Island. But you couldn't smoke pot. And this was a partying crowd that, you know, liked to smoke pot. So people were outdoor smoking pot. Some people had booze in their car. Some people were hooking up. I mean, there's a lot of it. This is a party. This is a rock show. And so it's a fluid situation as to who's inside the building and who's not. So key probably to finding out is what's the clicker. So at the door, there's a person taking note of people going in and out, Andrea Mancini, and she is this clicker. And so according to previously secret grand jury testimony, several witnesses said that they saw the clicker, and it put the crowd just before showtime at 325, maybe 350, something like that, but certainly below the capacity of the club at 404. Well, Andrea perishes in the fire, and the state never reports finding the clicker in the aftermath. So that would have provided a really important clue to let us know. But beyond that, right. you have witnesses. So one of the main characters of, or subjects, I should say, in the book, we talked about Gina and Fred. Gina talks about how that when she and Fred got there, that they got there just minutes before showtime, that they were able to walk up right to the stage. And it was crowded, but not, you know, so crowded that they couldn't move around. They had one of the band members of Jack Russell's Great White was kind of this savant when it came to estimating crowd sizes, probably because the band gets a cut of the door in a lot of places. So yeah. he had this ability to estimate a club and how many people were in it. And he's the first person, actually, to testify before the grand jury. And he has this astounding memory. Like, he can just go through all the different venues they were at in the last several years and say, yeah, that place we had, you know, 250, this place we had 175, whatever. And he estimates it as being about 350. The officer, they had an off-duty officer there for safety purposes that the Darien brothers had hired. He put it in, like, the 300s. But all of that said, what happens in the aftermath is one of the local news organizations, the local newspaper, the Providence Journal, determines that they, even though they've been told, you know, this is a difficult thing to know because people are in and out, and even though there's this other evidence out there, they decide that they are going to solve this riddle. And so what they do is they set a huge team of reporters and journalists to try to determine exactly how many people are inside that nightclub. And the article that they do says that there were 412. And they put this on the front page while the grand jury is meeting and while this being determined whether or not there are going to be any criminal charges. And they just make this statement that the club was illegally overcrowded based on their information. Well, when you look at their story quite carefully, you find out that, in fact, they had not confirmed all of those people of that 412, then in fact there was 111 of them who they never even spoke to. They were people like friends of friends, like, you know, I saw Dave there, so Dave's name ended up on the list. They heard from lawyers, personal injury attorneys, who were all jockeying at that point to get as many people signed up in a lawsuit against all the responsible parties or legally liable parties, and so they just, you know, came with a whole list of people. I mean, later I would hear from people that said when they saw that list of names, and the newspaper, to his credit, published all the names, so people would look at it and say, well, that person wasn't there, that person wasn't there. One of the people they had on the list was a guy who is seen on a YouTube video running to the fire. He's a journalist. He's a photojournalist trying to get pictures of the fire. He's seen running to the fire, responding to it to cover it, and he is on the journal's list as somebody who is inside the nightclub when the fire started. So the other flaw in the Providence Journal's reporting was that that capacity I spoke about, the 404, that only accounts for the public areas of the nightclub. And this is very clear when you study the grand jury testimony of the fire inspector, is that the 404 only applies to the square footage where people are standing who are patrons. So the staff in the kitchen, behind the bar, the band behind the scenes, the green room, none of those people can be counted in that 404 capacity because they're not in the public part of the club. So Jeffrey Dedarian, we talked about him, he's behind the bar, he's doing bar back, he's running up and down to the basement cooler storage room to the bar. He can't be counted in that capacity number, but he is counted in the Providence Journal story. So there's this problem with the Journal does this, and the Journal is a very powerful news organization in that area, so if the Journal says it, it has a lot of weight. And so the public was basically told by an authoritative source that the club was illegally overcrowded, and that is what people believe. But the truth is, we don't know for sure that it was illegally overcrowded. Now, is 404 too many people for a club that size? That's a different question, and it's a really good question to look at. Was the capacity set too high for a club of that size? We know for a fact, of course, because of what happened, that the club could not be safely evacuated in time to save everyone's life. But in determining how capacity, they're not thinking that the walls of the club are covered in gasoline and that people are only going to have a minute to live or die. They think of evacuations, you know, a normal fire that would have not been lit by this accelerant would not have gone up this quickly, and people would have had enough time to get out. Each of the doors, were four exits to the club, each of the doors was rated to be able to let 150 people per minute out each of those doors, which would be obviously 600, which would be the rough math on that. But of course, that's not how things happened in reality when it came right down to it. But again, in calculating clubs, you know, the capacity, there's no way a fire inspector would have thought that, well, and of course we're going to take into account the idea that this place is so explosive that this just not would have happened. But, you know, the other failing of this that gets a lot of attention and is worth talking about is the fact that why didn't the fire inspectors notice this foam on the walls and test it to make sure that it was the non-flammable type and not the flammable type? It's actually, that's what they're supposed to do. That's part of inspections, and it's done all the time in public venues. If a bar or a nightclub put up a new curtain, for example, or a theater, when the inspector comes by, they're supposed to either ask for the paperwork that shows that this curtain is flame retardant, or they have to snip off a little piece of it, bring it out to the parking lot, and try to set it on fire to see if it's flammable or not. So that type of inspection was not done. That foam had been on the walls for about almost 3 years, and the club had been inspected many, many times, even just a few weeks before the fire had been declared safe. It's part of the reason why the TV journalist was at that particular place to get the B-roll for that story about safe public venues. He was working with Jeffrey Dedarian, who was a co-owner of the club, and Jeffrey had to get this B-roll, and he thought, well, why not shoot it at my club? It's passed all its inspections, and so it's a safe club, so this is an example that we can use, at least in a generic sense, of a safe venue. And, of course, then everything goes horribly, horribly wrong. But as somebody said later, only a crazy person would have invited in a photojournalist into a club that they thought was inherently dangerous.
Absolutely. Let's stop for these messages. Now, it's interesting you talk about the journal and them overestimating or not knowing at all whatsoever what the capacity of that club was, reporting that it was overcrowded and it was beyond capacity. But more importantly was the portrayal by all media and the journal about the portrayal of who was culpable in this. So tell us who you believe was obviously targeted in this, the three players.
Well, it's interesting that, so one of the things that happens, I call this a rush to judgment, which some people have a tough time getting their head around, because, in fact, it took years for the legal wranglings of this case to play out and for the legal aspects to end. All of this ended with plea bargains and legal settlements. The plea bargains were done under enormous pressure for the people, the accused, to do some sort of plea, and that took years. But when I talk about a rush to judgment, I'm talking about what happens in the first moments and in the first hours of this tragedy. So as this awful catastrophe is happening, the local police chief tells the Associated Press that the nightclub business owners, the Darien brothers, quote, most definitely will be indicted. So he has already pronounced who he thinks is guilty in this case, and he has done no investigation. And I remember I was watching this, like so many people, because of that horrible video. This story, you know, the tragedy in itself is enormous. And then that video because that video existed, the story became viral before we even used words like viral, and had been shown all over the world. This video of the fire has probably been seen by hundreds of millions of people. Well, I was one of them. I was sitting out in California, and I'm watching this unfold on CNN. And, of course, I remembered that Jeffrey was a co-owner of that club. And in fact, because I'm local, I had been in that club years earlier myself and had seen it myself. So I was interested, and when I heard that this comment, well, the police chief had decided who was guilty before there was an investigation, I immediately thought, well, gosh, that's not right. That seems like a rush to judgment. But being out in California and not being a part of the Rhode Island news media at that point, it really is nothing I could do about it. But it did plant that question in my mind as to what in the world is going on. Now, those who may or may not know much about Rhode Island has It's a very shaky history when it comes to corruption. It's known as one of the most corrupt states in the United States. I mean, they've had governors go to prison, mayors. You've had two Supreme Court justices resign in disgrace or because of mob ties or misuse of, you know, it's just, that's kind of how things roll in that state. So, and because I had worked there and covered the news there, I was well aware of the corruption and just thought, well, this is just another example of Rhode Island corruption. You know, pronouncing guilt before you've even done 1 minute of investigation. So what happens, the chief says this to the Associated Press. It gets picked up all over the world. It's even carried by Fox News. Well, what happened then, though, was this dramatically, this has a domino effect that dramatically changes and alters the investigation and, frankly, the outcome of this case and this and how we our understanding of it. So until that moment, the Dedarian brothers, who as the owners of the nightclub business, had all the keys to the castle. They were the ones who knew everything. They knew how the business operated. They knew what was where. They could answer all of these questions. And, in fact, they had done interviews with the police and prosecutors, the state police, investigators. Jeffrey had done two lengthy interviews the night of the fire, telling them everything he knew. And as far as he was concerned, from his perspective, somebody came in his club and set off a bomb and killed all these people. So he's seeing it from that perspective, that they have been, you know, suffered this horrible disaster, that he's part of that. So he's telling them everything he knows, and they get Michael. Michael's out of town. Michael's in Florida. They get Michael on the phone. Michael cooperates. Michael does an interview with police, telling them what he knows. And so they are cooperating, but then word gets out about what the police chief has said. And then lawyers for the brothers say, you have to stop cooperating. You have to stop talking. You may never speak to another investigator again, because they have already concluded that you are guilty before they have done an investigation. So you can't talk to them. So they stop. And that alters the investigation. They also stop talking to the local news media, because at the same time, their lawyers are like, look, clearly you are going to be accused in this of a crime and all of this. So we're going to do this in court. You're going to be, you know, if there's going to be a trial, we're going to present our evidence in court, not in the media. So it takes all of Jeffrey's restraint, because he is a journalist. He, in fact, when he worked for me, he was the type of reporter who we would send, you know, to chase the bad guy down the street, you know, stand outside the courthouse and yell at the person, did you do it, did you do it? And then actually, you know, he's that guy. He's the accused. He's the one that everyone's coming after and saying, did you do it? So it took a lot of, I think it really killed him not to speak to the media, but he did not. And also, when they decided they would not cooperate with the media, they would not do an interview with the Providence Journal, things change. I did an accounting of newspaper articles from just in the aftermath of the fire. And so the Providence Journal, which is trying to get the Dedarians to speak, and they refused to speak, did 122 articles regarding the Dedarians in the aftermath. And during the same period, they only did 18 that mentioned Daniel Beakley, the guy who actually set off the bomb. The bomb that killed all the people. So the guy who undebatably did this, he is basically, you know, taken out of the attention, and all the attention shifts to the Dedarians. And it goes into stuff that is very questionable. I mean, they're looking at Michael's Dedarian's divorce, and the fact that it was contentious and not amicable, and, you know, that's spun up into all sorts of drama. They published their home addresses, their street addresses in the newspaper, something that is very dangerous to do. I think today we would call it doxing, that people do, you know, try to get revenge on people in the media, use the media as revenge. Sure. The newspaper doesn't, by the way, never publishes the home street addresses of anyone else who is seen as culpable in this tragedy, but prints the Dedarian brothers, which puts them at risk. They had to move out of their homes. They had, you know, some, Jeffrey had 4-year-old kids, twins. So there were antics like that raise a lot of serious questions about how did the media impact not just the case, but what the public knows about the case. Early on, there's a scene in the book which I was fascinated to hear about and to get it confirmed, where two of the most, arguably the most powerful men in the state at the time, the governor Don Cherry, and Joel Rawson, who is the editor-in-chief of the Providence Journal newspaper, they meet in the back room just days after the fire and get into a terrible fight about who's going to control the narrative of this story. Who is going to determine what the public knows and what the public will not know about this fire? Imagine, this actually happened. We think that stuff that only happens in drama. When I spoke to both of the men about this, they each told me the story from their perspectives, and their perspectives were identical. I don't think I've ever had that as a reporter, where two people saw things exactly the same way. So to my mind, maybe they're the only two people in the room, so they're the only two confirm this, but think of that. People are trying early on to control the narrative of the story. What is the public going to know and what is the public not going to know? And so that's troubling. That's troubling about when it comes to transparency about this. You know, in my mind, one of the deadliest fires in United States history, there shouldn't be any unanswered questions. And because of that, because there have been unanswered questions, I'm not sure that the lessons of this fire that should have been learned were actually learned. This is not a safe building. It was obviously not properly inspected. It did not have proper safety controls. And so a lot of people died as a result of that. I'd love to say that, you know, in the aftermath, everything changed and now we have safe buildings, but it's not true. Just a few years ago out in Oakland, California, the Ghost Ship fire, 36 people died. Different facts, different circumstances, but the same in that this is a dangerous building. It did not have sprinklers. People were allowed to gather there. It was not inspected. I mean, does this sound familiar? So all these years later, we have a similar tragedy happen because we really didn't learn the lessons that we should have that came out of the Station nightclub fire.
Tell us now about how the grand jury is convened and the talk of any kind of plea bargain at that point.
Well, the grand jury meets almost immediately in the days afterwards. In fact, for me as a journalist, the once secret grand jury transcripts are just a goldmine of information because people are sworn, obviously giving sworn statements. They're supposed to be telling the truth. But also, because it's done so quickly after the fire, their memories are fresh, and when you're assessing like what to believe and what not to believe as a journalist, documents like that that are contemporaneous to the time are, you know, generally you give them more weight than somebody trying to remember something, you know, 15 years later where they may or may not have the same command of the facts. So what happens inside that grand jury room is that much like the police chief said, the decision has already been made that the nightclub business owners are the ones who are going to take the fall. And almost every witness and almost every question gets around to pointing the finger at the Dedarian brothers. And it's really fascinating. Right. There's some people who are put on the stand who don't even know the brothers, who performed at the club years before the brothers even owned the nightclub business, and somehow they're expert witnesses, and they'll even say things like, you know, I wouldn't know those guys if they walked into the room right now. I've never met them, never done business with them, and yet somehow they're there. And then the prosecutor will say, well, what do you think of them? It's like, well, what are they supposed to think of them? They don't know them.
Yeah.
It really was all designed to get that result. And part of the reason that happened was something that gets revealed in the book is what the Attorney General refers to as the document. So the document is a fascinating little sidebar in this whole investigation because in the fire aftermath, and you have to remember, we're seeing things today, you know, looking back in time, we have a command of the information, we know what happened today, but when this unfolds, it's not immediately clear that there's deadly foam on the walls. People don't immediately understand all the things that went wrong that led to this horrible tragedy. They're still putting together the pieces, so they're trying to make sense out of chaos. So one of the things that the Attorney General does is he sets out his team to investigate other major fires where a lot of people died, whether in the United States or overseas. And what he wants them to do is look and explain, in those cases, who were the people most likely to be indicted? Who were the people, and if they were indicted, were they convicted? And if they were convicted, how many years in prison did they spend for their crimes? And so he creates this, he calls it the document, and it became his guiding force for the entire prosecution. And what he found was that in these cases, historically, it's the nightclub business owners who are the ones who take the fall. So you could look at this one way and say, well, that's smart. He's looking at precedent. He's looking at what the system allows. Or you could look at it another way and just say that he basically this was indictment by spreadsheet, not by, instead of following the facts of this particular case, and in this particular case, what should we be looking at? Should we be looking at that, the ban? Should we be looking at that fire inspector not doing his job? Should we be looking at that foam company? None of those people are looked at because they're not on the spreadsheet. They're not part of the document. The document says, go for nightclub owners. And so that's what they did. And so all of this other stuff is almost excluded or diminished or pushed to the side. I mean, there are some things in the, when you look very closely at the grand jury testimony, there's some astounding things that are said in there, and they're either ignored or brushed over or diminished to the point where the grand jurors themselves actually stand up to the prosecutors. It's an amazing thing to read for them to say, yeah. Well, wait a minute. Wait, what do you mean we can't go after the fire inspector? Well, what about these foam people? They're incredulous that they are being pushed in only one direction, which is go get those nightclub owners. And to the point where they're saying, I don't understand, like, why can't we do these other things? They push back, but basically they're told there's nothing in the law that allows for indicting anyone else except who they say they're supposed to indict. And so the grand juries themselves are quite troubled by this, but in the end, they do what the Attorney General tells them to do, and he is determining what to do from this document.
Now, what are the plea agreements that are discussed and the practical time that would be served in reality for Beakley and to the two brothers? And how's it come about?
Right, so Beakley is the other person who is indicted, and that's more of a slam dunk because he is the person who broke the law, the fireworks law. He set out the fireworks. He lit the bomb, so to speak, and he does take a plea bargain. What's interesting about the way the law is, there's two things that cause particular outrage when the legal aspects of this case play out. Number one is that there's nothing in the local law that allows anyone to be held criminally accountable for injuries. So we've talked about the 100 people who died. There are hundreds more who are hurt. Some of them suffer wounds that they will have to deal with for the rest of their lives. And the suffering is hard to get your mind around. Burns are a terrible thing to experience, and it happens on a scale that basically, you know, almost overwhelms the entire medical system for New England to deal with this one night. So people are understandably bitter and angry because they've been hurt, and no one is going to ever be criminally charged for them being hurt. So already you have hundreds of people, and by extension of that, thousands of friends and family who are outraged that there was going to be no justice for those people at all. So now we only have the ability to go after the folks who were killed. And so in order to do that, though, they have to take a smaller criminal act, an infraction or a misdemeanor. And in the case of Daniel Beakley, it's the fireworks. You know, no one goes to prison for lighting off, for having illegal fireworks or lighting them off in Rhode Island. It's not an offense that gets people put in the slammer. And so Right. You've got to take this infraction, this misdemeanor, and then tie it to the fact that so many people died, and now you get to a manslaughter charge. And so he does plead to that, but because he didn't know the place was a death trap, he didn't know about that foam on the walls, there's an argument to be made that, in fact, he can only be held so responsible because of all of these other extenuating circumstances. And by the way, the underlying charge is one that people never go to prison for. So when he does his plea bargain deal, he basically is sentenced to the equivalent of 18 months to serve in prison. Well, 18 months for 100 people being killed does not go over well. And so now there's a second wave of outrage that justice is never going to happen in this case because look at this guy. He killed 100 people, and he's going to serve 18 months. It's just the craziest thing. And that is sentencing, which is carried live all over the world by CNN because it is so crazy, just so dramatic. Family member after family member gets up and just really unloads their rage and their anger at how the legal system has let them down. So, but that takes care of Daniel Beakley, the guy who set off the bomb. So after that, there's only two people left, because remember, the grand jury was only allowed to indict so many people, and that's the right. Guderian brothers. And they are put in this situation where all of it, any ability for people to feel that justice has been served, all comes down to their case. And so there's enormous pressure on them to take a plea bargain. One of the things that I learned very early on this, it actually drove me to turn this into a book, was that the defense and the prosecution all did what were called mock trials. So mock trials are basically kind of a practice trial before you get to the real trial. And you have jurors, and you have evidence, and then you see, kind of test out your theories as to how things would go in court. And so there were three mock trials, and in each of the three mock trials, the jurors will not convict the Guderians. So when I heard about the mock trials early on, when I started asking those questions 10 years ago, that's when it hit me that I wasn't the only person who questioned what happened in this case, because when the right. mock jurors were presented with all of the evidence, not just one side of the story that came from the government, but with all of it, they would not convict. So that was part of my job after hearing about the mock trials, was to find out, well, what did those mock jurors hear that the public never heard that made them decide that, no, it's not so simple as these guys or these three guys are the whole story. I think, look, the public was let down by the institutions that we think are going to be there to protect us. There's no reason, no good reason, why a public venue that has hundreds of patrons doesn't have sprinklers. You know, sprinklers are technology from the 1800s. There's no reason for a building to be so unsafe by design. There's no reason for a building to be not properly inspected, and on and on and on. So again, the perfect storm of fire, so many things went wrong, but people were let down. The government itself, I think, bears an enormous responsibility in this case. But the government does not indict itself. It has to indict someone else. And I think that in this case, there was a effort to find scapegoats to hang this on, because the people who were partially responsible, the system, the establishment, was not going to hold itself criminally accountable.
It's incredible, too, that you talk about this 18 months in real terms for
yes.
this Beakley, and it would be a work release program, and they offered the same thing to the brothers. Tell us about this bizarre deal that one has to choose to go to prison.
Right. So this is another twist in the story, and it's a fascinating to read it, because it all plays out in a Dunkin' Donuts in Cranston, Rhode Island, and that's where the brothers meet with their wives to discuss what are they going to do, are they going to take this plea bargain or not, and they meet at the Dunkin' Donuts because they can't meet at their home because they have small children. They don't want to overhear this. But basically, in the end, they're pressured into to take a plea bargain because of all the, you know, it had happened for the Daniel Beakley. And there, a similar deal is offered to them, but with a twist. And the twist is that they must, only one of them is going to go to prison. The concept here was buy one, set one free. That's actually the language that was used behind the scenes to describe the deal. And the idea was that there's two brothers. One will go to prison, the other one will stay out and take care of their families, try to earn a living, try to support people, while the other one serves the time on behalf of both of them. But the twist is they have to decide amongst themselves which one is going to go to prison. So think of that. So they're at this Dunkin' Donuts, like, you know, who's better to go to prison, you or me or him? Or it's just crazy, because these are, you know, just working class guys. Neither of them have any experience with the criminal justice system. Neither is a hardcore criminal, knows anything about all of this. And so they go into this debate, who's better suited to be the one to be behind bars? And in the end, they make a decision, and it turns out to be the wrong decision for so many reasons that you can read about, which to kind of boggle the mind how the system works. But in the larger sense, the fact that they took this plea bargain thinking that this would kind of bring things to a closure, to allow the state to begin to heal, to allow people to move on with their lives, to get this behind them, not just them and them families, but also the victims' families and the survivors, that this would be a turning point, that it would finally put these proceedings to an end. But it has the opposite effect. The public is livid that these guys have been given any sort of plea bargain. There are people who think that they're murderers and that they should be given the death penalty for what happened. So, yeah, no, it does not work out the way that they think it's going to work out or the way the public thought it was going to work out. In fact, people are, I think, possibly more angry than ever once this plea bargain plays out.
Now, Michael gets a rough ride in prison because he doesn't seem to get, once he's in prison, the same deal as Beakley, and he's not let on a work release program initially. He has a tough time in prison and ends up doing a lot more than 18 months. How does it come? Tell us about the conditions in that the civil case goes forward.
Right, so that people understand, the criminal case is one we're talking about so far with regard to the charges, the manslaughter charges that everybody faced. But there's also the case of damages. So the civil case is going to determine, who's liable financially and in that respect. And that case goes on for years and years and years and years. I mean, it's really not settled quickly. It goes through a lot of different twists and turns. Probably, first of all, the way the local law was, they actually had to go to the state legislature and essentially get a special waiver in order to hold people responsible, kind of a wider net. And then the legislature allows them to do this, and then in fact they sue everybody and anybody who has any connection to this venue, this concert, the beer sponsors. They sue the TV station, and we talked about that local TV news photographer who's in there, who happens mm-hmm. to be rolling, taking pictures, B-roll for his upcoming story. They sue him and his TV station, and people contend that he, by being there, his presence, that he blocked people from leaving, that people perished as a result of him being present. They sue Home Depot because I guess plywood from Home Depot was used in the construction of the building. It goes on and on and on and on. And in the end, they are able to get an amazing amount of money, $176 million, to help people, the survivors and the victims' families, out of all this. But they don't get the money, at least not all of it. So the lawyers pocket $59 million of that, which is really kind of an astonishing amount. It's what they're legally yeah. entitled to, but a lot of people thought that wasn't right because, they could have covered their costs and a little bit more. The idea that they would profit to that amount was very controversial. What's left over gets divided up, but by the time this all plays out, others have gotten to the victims' families and the survivors, and they've gone to them and they've got them to sign deals. And the deals are basically, look, this settlement's going to happen someday. I'm going to upfront you some money. I'm going to give you some money now. In exchange for that, I get to have your settlement money when the deal finally comes through. So those type of deals are played out behind the scenes. These are working class people. None of them can't work because they're so injured. They need help now. They need to survive. They need to not be evicted and lose their homes and their cars and all these things. And so a lot of them take this money, make these deals before the settlement. So by the time the settlement money finally pays out, they end up getting really pennies on the dollar. So that $176 million sounds really impressive, but in the end, it really didn't turn out to be the windfall for people that it should have been. It turns out not to be the safety net that they needed in order to continue with the rest of their lives. So very tough. Again, we not exactly how the story was presented necessarily been told so far, but the reality of what really happened behind the scenes.
And lastly, the memorial in 2017, and you talk, we didn't talk about all of the characters that you bring to life in here in the survivor stories, but the memorial Gina Russo attends. So tell us a little bit about this memorial enacted in 2017.
Well, so the site of the nightclub, immediately afterwards, after the a lot of the The remnants of the structure were taken away. They were actually reconstructed in a warehouse for the investigation into, especially for the civil investigation. So the lot is pretty much barren, and immediately is filled by makeshift memorials. People go in and they plant little crosses and all sorts of stuff to remember the victims of the fire. So this little grassroots, this makeshift memorial, exists for years and years and years. And there's an immediate effort to try to get the place turned into some sort of more permanent memorial, something a little bit, possibly a statue or something like that. But there are problems. One of the issues that we talk about in the book, really for the first time, is that there's a terrible fighting behind the scenes between the victims' families and the survivors. And it turns out that in many cases, the victims' families hate the survivors. It becomes this weird story conflict that plays out where they somehow have come to believe that the reason their loved ones are dead is because somebody who survived stomped on them on the way out to save themselves, none of which we know to be true at all. But it doesn't matter. This is what happens. It's dissension. So there's this fighting. And some of the people who are most outspoken also want to go after the owner of the nightclub properties. Remember I said the brothers were renters. They were, you know, they were had the business, but they were not the owners of the property. So they go after the owner of the property, and they're trying to vilify him, and he should have known, and all of this stuff. Well, at the same time, they're asking the owner of the property to donate the land. So on one hand, they're asking him to donate the land so permanent memorial could be made. On the other hand, they're vilifying the guy in the media and threatening lawsuits and all the rest of it. So that's not exactly how you win somebody over to make a donation. But after the settlements are made in the case, and he is among those, the owner of the property is among those who has to do a settlement, or at least his insurance company does, to put in that pot of money. So that's settled, that's done. And then Gina Russo, who is one of the survivors, and she heads up this task force to create a memorial, she is able to persuade him to donate the land. And then she goes on this journey of raising, I think, you know, between the in-kind donations and actual donations, the equivalent of a couple $1 million to build a really incredible memorial at this site. I mean, you go there, and it's so devastating. Each of the 100 victims is remembered with a marker, and there's a kind of a, looks like a chapel that oversees it. It's a living, it's a garden. It's going to grow and blossom. Every year that goes by, I go there. Every time I'm back in Rhode Island, I go and visit. Something new has you know, grown, or this is what was once a seedling now is like a little bit of a tree. I mean, it's really kind of amazing. And people go there, and they have their moment to remember their loved ones, and other people go there just to see it and to reflect. I mean, it's a powerful statement, a powerful memorial to those people. And so in that respect, people are being remembered. If you're in Rhode Island, it's something to see. It's something to have a few moments of introspection about.
I don't want to mention this too much, but what was the impression or the attitude towards Jack Russell in all of this, the leader of
Great people
White?
Feel that Jack never really did properly or genuinely apologize for what happened. And my own encounter with him is kind of telling. We talked a little bit over the years on and off, little bits of interviews here and there. I went and saw him doing one of his concerts. He's still out performing. And he had to go through this big, long process with a friend of his who's kind of the person who screens people who are going to talk to him. And I spent hours talking to that guy and was given the thumbs up. I guess I was okay to talk to. And then the night before our formal interview, where we were going to go through things in depth, he called me up. And he asked me for money. He intended to try to make money off of this tragedy. And I said no, and then he talked about some sort of back door, which I think is like show business talk for like, can I get a cut of the profits or something? And anyone who knows anything about the book business knows that, you know, books are not profit centers, to say the least. But it's something like 95% of books fail to make back their investment. And in fact, a project like this is very expensive to mount, and so there are no profits, and so there's no back door. And I just try to explain to them that in real journalism, in professional journalism, we don't pay people to tell their stories. No. So once this was made clear to him, he canceled the interview and has never spoken to me. Now, the good news for readers of the book is there's plenty to hear from Jack Russell, in fact, stuff that most people had never heard before, because even though he wouldn't answer my specific questions, he has not remained silent. One of the weird things he did recently was in the last few years he started to go public about the fact that he has a very serious criminal past that predates this fire, that in fact you could argue showed a real disconnect between for human life and safety. When he was a young man, he was involved in the way he described it was an attempted murder. So, and he went to prison, none of which was known, none of which was reported at the time of the fire, none of which was, I'm not convinced that even the prosecutors or the attorneys involved in the case even knew about this. So that is there, and that is a revelation that we get from Jack Russell, even though I did not pay him to speak to me. I would not pay him. And in fact, it's very important to note that no one was paid to participate in this. These are journalism interviews. No one was compensated, and no one will make any money off of the book.
His offer for donating to this memorial was also rejected by the group, wasn't it?
Yeah, he has over the years done things where he has offered to make a donation or do a show on behalf of something. And in fact, you know, one of the things in the aftermath, because there were so many years before there was a settlement in the case and people were suffering and people needed money, there was a grassroots effort to raise money for the victims' families and for the survivors. And his band did offer to do a concert series to raise money for that fund, they would call it the Station Family Fund. And you can read about that. It's one of the more bizarre scenes in the book, was where his representative comes to these people who are, you know, just lost loved ones. They're suffering from horrible burns. And this guy walks in and says, you know, he offers them a deal with the devil. The deal with the devil was, you know, the person who set off the bomb, the group that set off the bomb that killed all these people and hurt all you people, is now offering to do to take proceeds from their upcoming concert tour and donate them to this fund. And they have to decide, will we take that money or not? And it causes a lot of anger and a lot of disagreement. Let's put it that way. That's a nice way to put it.
I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Trial by Fire, a devastating tragedy, 100 lives lost, and a 15-year search for truth. We didn't go into all, but the reader will be able to get to hear all of the graphic, incredible tales of not only loss, but also of incredible survival. And and also some of the photos. There's one photo in particular that is incredibly remarkable in that it is the beginning of the fire on the wall, and there's three people there, including a member of the staff that's there smoking a cigarette. So it's an incredible collection of photos in this book. For people that might want to take a look, do you have a website that
Yes, you can go to scottjameswriter.com.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Scott James, for this Trial by Fire. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thanks again
for
this interview.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.